So I'm Rick Hansen. This is May 30th, 2012. And as I promised, or really warned, I thought I would do a deep dive with you into the territory of emptiness and continue the themes of the last two discussions I've had with you on the unconditioned and what emptiness is altogether. And emptiness is arguably the Buddha's most original contribution and most profound contribution to practice, and yet it can really be hard to understand, particularly if it's approached in certain ways. So I want to explore with you this subject over the next 3 weeks I'm here. Little announcement that also went out to you in the email blast I sent out. And by the way, if you want to get on the email list for the sitting group, there's a little yellow pad over there, or you can just email me and I'll add you to the sitting group. But anyway, I'll be here for the next 3 weeks, and then we'll have guest teachers, and then I'll be back and so forth. So as my way into this topic this evening, I'd like to talk about the three characteristics in Buddhism, and then focus in particular on impermanence, which is the entry, really, into recognizing the empty nature of things. And I want to really kind of slow down and unpack this consideration, and probably to a greater degree than is often the case in the past, have actually more discussion about what this actually means, so you can bring it down to your own experience. Okay. So specifically, as you may know, the Buddha said that everything has three fundamental characteristics. But before I go further, I have to tell you what he meant by everything. All right. So what he meant by everything was both materiality. Okay. In the Hindu philosophy of his time, that was seen as rupa, form, okay, materiality. Now we, 2,500 years later, know that materiality includes energy, since E equals mc squared, and materiality includes a lot of weird stuff, quantum foam, dark holes, dark energy, lots and lots of stuff we don't know about. It's kind of remarkable, actually, to appreciate that 96% of the universe was unknown to modern science 30 years ago. Just think about it. A woman astronomer discovered dark matter, this strange kind of matter that's totally unlike the ordinary matter in atoms, everyday atoms that make up our body, you know, the water in our body, the calcium in our bones, the iron in our blood. This stuff, dark matter, people don't really understand it. It's totally different. It doesn't seem to even interact with regular matter, except in terms of gravity. And then about 10 years ago, various other people in astronomy discovered dark energy, which is even weirder. Right? Dark matter and dark energy essentially make up 96% of the matter-energy constituents of materiality. So it's in this context of a kind of humility and modesty, right, that we appreciate that there's a lot of stuff we don't know about, but there's basically, you know, rocks are hard, water is wet, basic stuff, kind of down to earth. Okay, that's rupa. The Buddha acknowledged the existence of materiality in terms of traditional philosophical categories or Western philosophical categories. He was a realist. He did not believe in the mind-only school, that we just make it all up, okay? He thought that stuff was here, even if there was no particular consciousness to be aware of. The rest of the world, though, and where his primary focus was the world of our phenomenal experience, the world of experience. So when he talks about the nature of the world, the three characteristics, which I'll get to momentarily, of everything, he primarily is focused on the everything that we know. And all we know is our own experience, including our experiential representations of the world. We never know materiality directly. We only know our representations of it, our perceptions of it, sensations of it, the sounds of it, the sights of it, and so forth, or our conceptualizations of it, like what, you know, is going on in the rings of Saturn. We can imagine those sorts of things, or what's happening in terms of molecular processes with DNA that no one has ever seen, but can only deduce. Right? That's all we know. So that move, by the way, of coming into an intimacy with one's own experience is like, you know, because it's the NBA playoffs, I gotta give them a bow here. It's like a power move to the hoop. In other words, if you relate to your own experience very, very directly, then suddenly it's full of opportunities for wisdom, and it brings you home, brings you right here, takes you right out of conceptualization and right down into the moment-to-moment phenomena of experience, which is where the Buddha said we absolutely, again and again and again, should find our home. We should bring our awareness back into our direct experiencing. Okay. So what are the three characteristics of everything, especially everything that we know? Two of the three characteristics, by the way, apply to materiality. And all three characteristics apply to the phenomenal realm of our experience. The three characteristics work anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca is the Pali word for impermanence, change, ephemeralness, transience, flow, arising and passing away. And if you look closely, you can see that just about everything, and there's some interesting exceptions, which I'll get to, that are very interesting, just about everything is continually changing. Now, it may change on a slow time scale. You know, the peeling away of the flakes from El Capitan, although as I told a story, I had a friendly acquaintance who was a rock climber, and literally a flake peeled off just beneath his feet, you know, when he was climbing on El Capitan. So things change there, too. It may be slower, but change occurs. I mean, you may know that roughly in the normal processes of the evolution of a physical star, our own homely little sun, 93 million miles away where the light began 8.5 minutes ago, will gradually consume its supplies, get hotter and hotter, become a red giant so that its outer surface, because its outer surface is getting pushed away from its core, which is getting hotter and hotter, and the sun will actually expand to initially consume Mercury, and then Venus, and then Earth, kind of edging out. Probably won't get Mars, but it'll be springtime on Mars for maybe a few hundred or a few dozen million years. And then the sun will contract back again to become a homely white dwarf, a kind of standard white dwarf, having consumed this whole planet in the process. No more Grand Canyon, no more Sistine Chapel, no more Mona Lisa, right? No more Beatles greatest hits, archived somewhere. As the little children say, all gone, right? So there are different time frames, but impermanence is a reality, and impermanence is really a reality, obviously, in our own moment-to-moment experience. Just watch the mind, and the passing away of sensations, even thoughts. Who can think the same thought, precisely the same thought, over and over, or just continuously? You can't do it. The brain won't do it. I mean, the coalitions of synapses that form as the underpinnings of a conscious thought take 2, 3, 4 tenths of a second to come together, a little bit like an eddy in a stream, self-organizing and then forming. They'll persist as what they are in these kind of reverberatory loops for 2 or 3 seconds. And then whatever that coalition of synapses is, tens of millions of synapses that underpin a thought, you know, when I get home, I'm going to watch that rerun of The Good Wife. I've never seen it. Whatever. That little thought, those neurons that underpin it will not last for more than a few seconds. Those synapses, the coalition of synapses. Right now, think to yourself, 3 plus 3 is 6. Do you know that 3 plus 3 is 6? Okay, great. Now, think about something else. A thing you did when you were a kid that was fun. Thinking about putting firecrackers in rotten oranges and blowing them up. It was a lot of fun. I don't know what you were thinking about. All right, now let me ask you again. What's 3 plus 3? Do you think the same coalition of synapses formed, the exact same coalition formed, to underpin that knowledge? The answer is no. Probably partook of some of the same territory roughly in the neural network, but not the exact same selection out of the 500 trillion synapses in the brain. Right there, the knowing of 3 plus 3 is 6 changes. So our own experience is continually changing. The second characteristic is anatta, or interdependence, or nothing has absolute self-existence, even to the point of the actual sense of self, that things exist, they're existent, but they have no essential center. Okay. I'm going to come back to interdependence or anatta a little bit later on, probably next week, including the implications of that for the fundamental sense of being a stable eye, a being looking out through the eyes, as it were, the owner of experiences and the agent of actions, which in the Buddha's view is an illusion because it's empty of the constituting characteristics that make it an essence. They don't exist in the Buddha's view. Okay. The third, and so again, we can look out there in the world. Everything's connected to everything else. You know, gravitational fields, strange phenomena, strange stuff happens. You know, the comet hit the Earth, right? Around 65 million years ago, comet, asteroid, something, some big bang hit this planet about 65 million years ago, got rid of the dinosaurs, opened up a lot of ecological niches for our rat-like great-grandparents to fill, and we're sitting in this room today. Well, that, if you think about it, the Earth is going around the sun at around, I believe I calculated recently, about 62,000 miles an hour. That's pretty fast. The net of it is, whatever it is, here, add it up, we'll talk later. But anyway, my point is that there's a window here. So the Earth's speeding around the sun. This bullet's coming at the Earth, right? Basically, the Earth is moving, it's moving about 1,000 miles a minute. Well, the diameter of the Earth is about 8,000 miles, okay? That means there's roughly an 8 to 10 minute window over hundreds of millions of years, whereby if the Earth has moved a little bit further or hasn't quite gotten to that point where the path of the asteroid or comet crosses the Earth's orbit, it misses us, and it speeds on its way. And if anyone's sitting in this room right now, they've got scales and are probably cold-blooded. You know, no mammals, no us. If 10-minute window, that thing sped on by because the Earth is twirling around the sun that fast, about 1,000 miles a minute around the sun. Pretty bizarre to think about how everything's connected to everything else. So it's connected out there as well as in here. And then the third characteristic is dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. Now, I don't think, and the Buddha never claimed, to my knowledge, that rocks suffer. Materiality doesn't suffer as far as we know. But in our experience, we do feel contraction, dissatisfaction, frustration, discontent, tension, particularly when we try to grasp after that which is endlessly changing, or try to stabilize or essentialize that which is endlessly interconnected. That's the basic teaching of the Buddha in many, many ways. And practice is to bring it out of the head, down into the heart and the belly, and bring it into our actions, our enacted embodied existence, moment to moment, day by day. Okay. So where do we find impermanence? We find it in what the Buddha called the five aggregates of existence and the six sense spheres. So I want to name these kind of quickly and then talk about them. The first aggregate is form. Form is materiality, but mostly when we talk about the world as we experience the world, it's our bare apprehension that something's there. The second aggregate is feeling, not emotion, but rather more like, in psychology, was called hedonic tone. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? The Buddha here is talking about the elements of our experience. And his view is there's nothing but these five. So see if you can think of a sixth, all right? I haven't been able to. The third category is perceptions. He's sorting out experience. He's deconstructing each moment of experience into its elements. The third category is perceptions, where we know what a thing is. We are able to label it in some basic conceptual way if we want. We might have a memory related to it. We know what it is. Fourth category is all the mental formations, our thoughts, our plans, our inner language, our inner imagery, emotions, drives, desires, psychodynamics, personality structures, relationship paradigms, the whole kit and caboodle. That's in the category of the formations. All right. And then the fifth element of the aggregates are moments of consciousness, moments of awareness. Okay? So the Buddha's argument is that if you look into your own experience, you see that continually changing. You see the registration in experience that something's there, that's changing. Whether you like it or dislike it, it's feeling tone, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, that's continually changing. The perceiving of it, the labeling of it, that keeps changing. The various thoughts and reactions and desires and plans, worries, hopes, fears, loves, all that's changing. And moment to moment, consciousness is attaching itself to different objects of awareness, moment after moment after moment. Endless change in the aggregates. Right? And so if you look in your own experience and you start observing, what are the forms that I'm aware of? What are their feeling tones? Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Just what are the various perceptions that are popping into awareness, like awareness of this room right now? We're labeling moments of experience. That's a bird call. That's the feeling of the chair on my thigh. That's a kind of funny taste in my mouth. That's a neutral smell. It's perceptions. And then thoughts, all kinds of thoughts. Thoughts about what I'm saying, wandering thoughts, coming back thoughts, emotional reactions. Is this interesting? Is this boring? Are you falling asleep? Are you getting enthralled? Whatever, all that. You just recognize it. And then awareness, forming and passing away, forming, passing away, forming, passing away. For me, it's a little bit like, you may have heard me use this metaphor before, the field of awareness is like the surface of a cup of soda water, all right, a glass of soda water. Imagine a clear glass of soda water. What we're aware of is the surface of awareness with all these bubbles forming. And if we could slow it down, super slow-mo motion, we'd see bubbles slowly rising, not yet breaking the surface, forming, organizing, and then pop, passing away, and connecting as well with each other in various ripples. That's moment to moment, what's appearing and passing away in consciousness. And yet, on the other hand, if we shifted our view, right, from looking down on the glass to looking sideways at it, we could see the bubbles rising. The various causes underpinning all these changes that lead them to be what they are moment by moment by moment. And then, as I said, the six sense spheres, all this is happening in terms of objects of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and other things going on in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, even subtle intuitions, even mystical experiences, are experienced in the mind. Whatever it might be that we're experiencing, the experiencing is located within our own experience, by definition. Okay. So that's the Buddha's argument. His argument is that all that stuff is changing continually. And because it's changing continually, it's not stable. It's not a stable basis for deep happiness. So any effort to found our fundamental well-being on these shifting sands is doomed to dukkha, doomed to frustration, discontent, disappointment, dissatisfaction, and so forth. So, what questions do you have about this that are real for yourself, particularly when you look in your own experience? This is foundational dharma, you know, and I think it's really important to get it and to see what you think about it, obviously. It's easy to make it heady and conceptual. It really helps to bring it down. Bird call. Sensation in chair. What's the actual nature of my moment-to-moment experience, and is it stable? What do you see for yourself? Yeah, please. Yeah, I don't know that tradition very well, the Christian Science tradition, or the view of spirit. But if we could, let's do that, what I call the power move to the hoop. Like, we could consider this in fancy language ontologically in terms of what is existent, what is reality. So we could consider, is there spirit out there, much as there might be atoms out there or a sun out there, right? Or an ice cream truck parked outside our front door as a real physical existent thing or some kind of existent thing, right? Or we could bring it back into our experience. What's his experience of spirit? I bet you, phenomenologically, so moving from ontology to phenomenology, you know, from reality to experience, I bet his experience would have the characteristics the Buddha described. You know, a lot of his experience probably is more conceptual too. Like, does he have a, and even if he has a direct experience of spirit, what's the nature of that experience? Is it not impermanent? Does it not come and go due to causes? So when the causes change, it passes away. Do you see what I'm kind of getting at? If we bring it into our experience, we can. The other thing, too, is that if we try to think about it out there, it's conceptual and we don't really know what to do with it. We bring it in here, we can just see again and again, wow, the sounds that occur in awareness, the sights that occur in awareness, the sensations, the tastes, the smells, and the thoughts, they all have this characteristic of arising and passing away. Well, again, are we talking about art, let's say a sculpture, make it concrete. Are we talking about that sculpture out there, or are we talking about our experience of it in here? Our seeing of it, our sight of it, the sounds it makes when we rap upon it, the emotions that occur over here when we gaze upon it. Does it have a smell? You know, if we licked it, what would it taste like? Okay, all that's happening in here, okay? So then if you, again, you consider your own experience in here, what's its nature? Is it stable? Is it permanent? Or does it continually change? Even just gazing at a statue. I mean, I saw David when I was in Florence. Now, you know, it takes a lot to move my needle. That one definitely moved my needle. Mm-hmm. Michelangelo, my needle about art. Doesn't, you know, like I geek out on other things, but art, you got to really move my needle. But you know what's also really great there? They had these Mapplethorpe photographs of male figures, predominantly black and white, intermingled with Michelangelo's drawings. It was a brilliant thing. And it really, the whole thing really moved my needle. So there I am gazing at the David statue, which is huge. It's called Il Gigante because it's really big. I didn't know that. And it's up on a pedestal. And I can pull up my experience of being with it, and I can tell you my own experience of being with it, even though the object was static. I think the physical entity out there was static, but my experience of it was quite dynamic. You know, my attention would move from part to part of the statue. I'd have different thoughts about it, different associations. Moods would come and go about it. Right? That's our experience. Right.
So the more I sort of explore that too, yeah, you can't ever, everything's in constant change, constant flux. So there is no,
right.
You know, so then it's the consciousness being aware of, sort of like, you know, watching a movie. You're in there watching the movie and you get caught up with it and then you realize it's something else putting on the screen. So,
No, I thought you said it really well. Thank you for sharing there. I can tell you for myself that it's been kind of a weird and profound shift to really, it feels humble to appreciate that I live only in a virtual world. And by I mean the person process, you know. We never know the world directly. We only know our perceptions of it. And to really appreciate how incredibly constructed it is. That's the world in which we live. And it's weirdly disorienting. If you're prone to psychosis, stop listening. But otherwise, it's actually quite powerful and freeing to realize that we only live in our experiential world, always ever. And when we get that, in a funny kind of way, we lighten up about it. And we realize that it's not ever going to be fundamentally satisfying. We have to find reliable forms of satisfaction elsewhere. Yeah, please.
I was forming a question, something related to just what you're saying. So the more I understand impermanence and get close to it and see it, everything's changing super rapidly.
Yeah. Good.
And then I think, okay, well, this is the big idea is to end suffering.
Right.
So then, you know, is it that I will be less likely to become attached because I'll see the uselessness of it because I'm going to get burned. It's just going to change. And yet, I still get attached.
Right. Sure.
And then of course that also is impermanent, so I can see, well, it goes away, it's okay.
Yeah. You know, right.
But so I don't know exactly what my question is, but just that kind of the so what. So how is deep understanding, or maybe this is the question, over time will a deep understanding of impermanence, is the purpose of that to slowly loosen it?
Yes. That was beautifully said. And it absolutely right on. So I'll just repeat it slightly for the recording as kind of a summary, which is, and to me, it's heartening. And what you're talking about, again, is something I encourage all of us for, is an engagement with this kind of viscerally in your own consideration, directly. Like, why does this matter? Why should I care? So what that everything changes? But if you bring your awareness increasingly to it, it starts to becoming more and more compelling. And actually to the point that if it starts becoming disturbing, you're really getting into it. You know, in a good way. Now, some people shouldn't do this consideration because they're very fragile, all right? But so if you're psychotic, don't do this. But if you can, it can be quite powerful. And you're exactly right. The point of this inquiry and this, you want to have a deepening felt recognition. It often starts conceptually, and that's okay. It's like, okay, we have a map. I'm going to go to Oregon, never been there. My map's going to kind of tell me how to get there. I need my map. But more and more, I want to set aside the map and look around and enjoy the scenery and abide here when I get there, especially in Oregon. All right. So as we deepen our experience, really, our felt recognition of transience, you're right, it becomes increasingly, we become disenchanted. We wake up from the spell because it's very poignant, the degree to which the brain evolved to hold on to transient phenomena to help our ancestors survive. Like, literally, it essentializes things, and I wish there were a word for this, but it permanentizes them. Yeah, but it's even, so I wanted to do a little thing with you here kind of briefly, and we'll move to a wrap pretty soon. See this? So you see this, right? What's this? Right. Now, you know what your brain actually sees? So basically, light bounces off this and comes back to you. And the metal in this, the material here, absorbs basically all the wavelengths of light, except pretty much kind of gray and brownishness that come back to you. So that hits your retina. Your retina and a lot of different neurons in the retina, and then further back in the optical nerve and the processing of visual data, establishes horizontal planes, perimeters, outlines, looks, you know, pulls it together, and constructs an apparent entity, a thing, out of this vast chaos of neural processes and wavelengths of light. But that's what we do, because if we were a critter, and this were not a bowl but a banana, right? We'd need to essentialize that banana. We need to reach for that banana. We need to essentialize our partners. We need to essentialize, to some extent, the sense of an enduring self, an I, inside the mind of our partner, because that helps us survive. So in some sense, what we're talking about here is going against the stream. The stream of what, literally at the most basic perceptual levels, the brain is wanting to do. That's why we, in part, we develop concentration, to quiet the mind enough to start seeing that it's a little bit like when you step back 20 feet, it looks like an entity there in a painting, but when you get closer and closer and closer, you see the pixels, right? Where you take a picture on a computer and you blow it up, and after a while you stop being able to see what it is. You see how it's aggregated. It's formed of aggregates, right? That's part of what we try to do when we concentrate, is to see more and more deeply, and again and again and again and again, so we form conviction into the constructed nature of experience, moment to moment to moment. And then what happens, you're exactly right. We often go through a phase of a kind of despair. You know, I don't know if you've read my book, Buddha's Brain, but in the last chapter, I talk about that a little bit. Coincidentally, chapter 13, not that I'm suspicious, or superstitious, that's what I meant to say, nor suspicious. But anyway, I had my own time of despair, just like, wow, everything's connected to everything else. What's the point in any single part of it, including this part, you know, that had my name tag? So it's not unusual for people to have a kind of weird despair at the fleetingness of everything. But what then starts to happen is your attention starts moving away from the endingness of things to the renewal of things. And you start feeling increasingly like you're on the 29th floor, you hit the elevator button, it opens up and you step in, and there's no floor beneath you, but you're continually buoyed by this moment emerging of existence in the mind of awareness, moment after moment, right? You're aware of the falling away, but you feel endlessly renewed, right? Moment by moment by moment. And then what happens is an increasing kind of freedom. And the more that you're in your game and in the present moment awareness of this, there's a lightening up. There's a realizing, you know, that it's all flowing through. And what happens really curiously is people experience, I can, and people who are further along than I will talk really richly about it. There's this very inexplicable even sense of love. It really starts coming through. There's a sense of almost a love present in the arisingness, and there's a definite, at a human level, minimally, a loving, a compassion, a lovingness, an appreciation, a good-heartedness, a sweetness for all of this that just seems to come through. The more we're relaxed around the endless standing waveness, you know, of existence, including this moment of existence in our experience, moment after moment after moment. The Buddha said that whoever, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but whoever truly understands impermanence has penetrated to the heart of my teaching. That understanding impermanence, understanding transience in our experience is the essence of the Buddha Dharma, if that's of interest to you. Truly penetrating the transient nature, especially, again, the world. The world is the world inside. The world is the constructed world. That's the world he's talking about. Any last comment or question? Twofer. Okay, maybe Bill and Tarnay and I'll wrap. Okay?
Do you think that a person can really penetrate the concept of impermanence without meditating on a regular basis?
Oh, so can a person do that? I believe they can. You know, I think sometimes it helps to have that practice and then it kind of falls away. I've known... to
understand impermanence?
I think what happens is you get more and more in it. And sometimes your thoughts go away to patterns that are more stable, like you kind of stably think about, you know, I'm planning this party and what are the things I want about it? So the sense, there's some recreation that has some stability to it in one's own experience. But a lot, one comes back to a sense of the evanescence of this moment. And I think one starts increasingly just being in the now more and more, you know, and you just start, it's this weird paradox where the now never ends, but everything in the now endlessly ends. Kind of whack, you know, but the Buddha was called the happy one for a reason, right? And to go to the point too, it's like, all the teachings, there is no great teaching in this world that says cling more. In any tradition, right? And exactly, cling more. No, nothing says cling more. And it's what you were bringing up, that we deepen in our insight that helps us relax the clinging. We just live more in harmony with truth. Truth is anicca. Truth is transience. That's true. Transience in the material world, and in particular, transience in the phenomenal world of our own moment-to-moment experiencing. And as we come more and more into recognition of that truth, we live more and more in harmony with it. And the more we live in harmony with it, the more we soften, the more we open, kind of relax, lay down, you know. We find ways to persist in wholesome aspiration. We don't just give up and be carried along by life. We have intentions. They have some persistence to them. But we hold them more lightly without attachment. And we increasingly, in a certain sense, you know, abide as this present moment through which time flows, through which life and time flow. Is that enough for this evening? Is that okay? How about we just sit for a minute and just see what it's like to be in this now that never ends, through which time and life flow in very real ways, down to earth. Sounds change, sights change, sensations change, thoughts change. Letting go. We're talking about. Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's main teacher, as he said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. That's what we're exploring, letting go completely. Partly through recognizing the futility and holding on to the moment. Thank you.